This is Indy Sports Center, 1070, The Fan.
Touchdown!
WFNI, Indianapolis.
The Fan. I'm Mike Sarok, your host. This is the all-night race party from now until 6 o'clock in the morning when we really wake up this town and the whole world with what's happening on 16th and Georgetown. Tonight we're featuring 1968. That's the battle between the Turbines and Donald Davidson and Bobby Unser are going to bring the breakdown as what's happening with the facts in the background. All the stuff you probably never heard before. And we're going to go to 1978. Rick Mears, was he on his way? Yes, he was. He was co-rookie of the year with Larry Rice. Rick Mears is going to give us some insight, as well as Donald as well. And then we're going to go to 2008. The Iceman, Scott Dixon, he shows us how he takes a victory with muscle. That's all tonight. It's our 13th year, the all-night race party. And we're glad to have you along after all these years. And coming up in just a few minutes, back 40 years ago to 1968 on 1070, The Fan.
It's a good, good year, a good year, and a good year for your car. There's a great new Goodyear tire that takes you twice as far. It's a polyglass tire from Goodyear, a tire so wide and strong that the polyglass tire from Goodyear will last you twice as long.
Only Goodyear has the custom wide tread polyglass tire with a polyester cord body plus a fiberglass cord belt to give you up to double the mileage of our best-selling tires.
It's a good, good year for Goodyear and a good year for your car. 'Cause the polyglass tire from Goodyear can take you twice as far.
It's Dark and Wetzel for the best in good grilling, great eating wieners. Plump, juicy, and so nourishing. All lean choice meat. Rush fresh to your dealers in vacuum packages. Guaranteed to satisfy. Try Stark and Wetzel wieners.
Stark and Wetzel wieners, the freshest, tenderest, juiciest, tastiest wieners you ever enjoyed. Stark and Wetzel wieners are packed full of choice, lean, U.S. government-inspected beef and pork. Strictly quality controlled, bursting with gentle spices, and cooked to a tender perfection. Almost instant enjoyment for the whole family, and all-around eating fun you can serve in so many ways. Try them baked in buns, or sliced into pancakes. Simmer them in casseroles, or grill them outdoors. Stock up on Stark and Wetzel wieners in the 1 pound, 10-pack now. You can count on keeping that flavor and good nourishment protected until you're ready to serve them. Because Stark and Wetzel wieners are vacuum sealed and airtight packages to keep the freshest taste in town. Stark and Wetzel wieners, the freshest taste in town.
This is Indy Sports Center, 1070, The Fan. WFNI, Indianapolis.
It is the all-night race party. I'm Mike Sarawick, your host, and we're already seeing some things that are happening with these doggone turbines. Some people liked them. A lot of people didn't like them. But what's happening that's really amazing is Bobby Unser is starting to make a face for himself. What we have is we have Donald Davidson and Bobby describing what's happening here in these first few laps.
Anyway, the real battle through the month was with Bobby Unser, who was driving a turbocharged Alfie, which was fairly new at that time. 66 was the first year for turbo offies, and they had, you know, problems with them. And so 68 was the first year that several drivers were using them, and that it was now a potential winner. And so it was a full month of May, and I think there must have been probably close to 2 weeks of practice before you ever got to qualifying. And there was a lot of one-upmanship about who could be the first to do a 170 mile an hour lap, and unofficially it was Bobby Unser with the Gurney Eagle owned by Leader Codes. And but I mean, that was just on the clocks. That was unofficial. And when I said on the clocks, I think they caught that on the electric eye, but it was pretty much stopwatches and not official in any way. He qualified outside front row. And then Art Pollard qualified a third turbine, and so it was pretty much, it was one against three in most people's minds. Although, of course, there was other contenders. There was Mario Andretti, although he had a very disappointing 1968, and Foyt was the defending winner. And you had your usual cast of characters, and Gurney, and so on and so forth. But it looked like it was Bobby Unser versus the turbines, and that's what it turned out to be. But the really surprising thing was that you just figured that the turbines would pretty much run away with the thing. And I think it was on lap 7, I remember this like it was yesterday, when Leonard had been leading, and then I did a double take, and I thought, did I imagine that? I think Bobby Unser was ahead of the turbines. And I don't think it came over the PA right away, and I looked around to see, you know, what other people's reactions were, and it was almost as if it had happened without anyone noticing. And just the very idea that Bobby Unser could pass the turbine just seemed, you know, almost unthinkable, or at least a real surprise that early in the race. So you thought, okay, well, there's going to be a battle here, or maybe the turbines are just holding back. And as the day went on, Bobby Unser sort of pretty much dominated the event.
They expected to be the fastest. The press did. All the people did. And all of a sudden, somewhere, I don't know, 6 or 8 laps, I don't recall right now, that I just saw that it was going to be easy. to take the lead, and so I did. And I thought that would wake Leonard up. If he had anything that he was hiding, that would wake him up and he'd come back by. But I was able to even pull away. So then I knew that there was something going on. I was in better shape than they were, see. But remember, my car should have been less reliable. They didn't have to worry about transmissions. They didn't have to worry about reciprocating engines, valves, jumping out and getting broken, all that type of stuff that you have problems with automobile type of engines, see?
Now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
Put your money on a real crowd pleaser. Try Grandstand Frights, the great new taste from Stark and Wetzel. Grandstand Franks are packed plump to bursting with good, lean meat. Always U.S. government inspected, spiced for excitement, and cooked to tender, juicy perfection. They're terrific for cookouts and picnics. Just heat them or grill them, and you'll serve up plenty of natural protein nourishment with Grandstand fun and flavor. Stock up on Grandstand Franks now in 1 pound vacuum packs. And don't forget, even the labels are good. Each Grandstand Frank label is good for one free admission to the Indian Spokane game on Stark and Wetzel night, June 7th. So bring those labels to the ballpark and enjoy free grandstand fun. And at home, you'll enjoy the freshest taste in town with Grandstand Franks by Stark and Wetzel. A lot of exciting questions will have been answered when this year's great 500-mile classic is over. And one of them is, who will win the Rookie of the Year trophy? This is the impressively beautiful trophy established by Stark and Wetzel in 1952. Each year, this Stark and Wetzel trophy honors the driver who, making his first appearance in this annual racing classic, best exemplifies the qualities of courage, sportsmanship, and skill in winning his way into the company of those men who challenge barriers of time and space to make this the greatest event in all automobile racing. See if this time you can spot this year's Rookie of the Year. Following your choice will add to your enjoyment of the race, just as Stark and Wetzel's fine meats add to your mealtime enjoyment every day. That's Stark and Wetzel, meats with the freshest taste in town.
Fan, it's the all-night race party, reliving the memories of 1968. You know, we're not used to seeing different varieties of engines and cars running at Indy, especially this year. Everything's in Honda. But back then, in 68, they were running turbines, and there had been a rumor that following the turbines, you felt like you had cotton in your mouth. And when I talked with Bobby Unser, I asked him if that was true and what other senses he realized when he was running behind or in front of the turbine.
Well, no, absolutely no truth to that. And I guess I should know better than anybody.
But, absolutely.
But instead, what it did is it put out what you would call a heat wave. In other words, you could just see all the heat because it came out on top of the car and then, of course, went backwards. But no, it wasn't the smell that bothered me. And yes, you could smell the diesel fuel, turbine fuel. But what's the big deal to that? I mean, that was really not an issue. I guess it's the first time I've ever heard that issue, but it did happen as far as your eyes. Sometimes if you were following or if I was following one of the turbines, I never followed two of them. You got to remember that. They were just, you got to know that they were not in my eyesight.
Mm-hmm.
Leonard and Graham Hill, they were way back. I mean, they just weren't part of it. It was just Joe Leonard, myself, and Lloyd Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
That was what the race was really about. And it was the heat waves that the turbine put out that was bad because you couldn't see a long ways in front. In other words, I could see up to Leonard okay, but to see on past him, your depth perception would be real bad because of the heat waves, see?
It's a good year for good year, and a good year for your car. There's a great new Goodyear tire that takes you twice as far. It's a polyfast tire from Goodyear, a tire so wide and strong that the polyfast tire from Goodyear will last you twice as long.
The custom wide tread polyglass tire has a polyester cord body plus a fiberglass cord belt to give you up to double the mileage of our best-selling tires.
It's a good year for good year.
The polyglass tire, only Goodyear has it.
When you talk about tender, you're talking about Stark and Wetzel wieners, the tenderest wieners in town, and the freshest, most flavorful, mouth-watering, juicy wieners you ever tasted. Stark and Wetzel wieners are worth whistling about. In fact, your family will stand up and cheer every time they taste that good, lean, government-inspected beef and pork. The subtle tang of just-right seasoning, cooked to juicy perfection. And you'll applaud Stark and Wetzel wieners for their wholesome, muscle-building protein goodness. Easy to serve in so many ways. For sandwiches, casseroles, parties, outdoor picnic fun. Stock up on several 1-pound, 10-packs today. And be ready for almost instant enjoyment, anytime, kitchen fresh and flavorful. And Stark and Wetzel wieners are vacuum sealed to keep the freshest taste in town. Stark and Wetzel caters to your tastes. In fact, Stark and Wetzel luncheon meats cater to everyone's tastes. Over 20 different varieties, with a flavor favorite to please any appetite. And all Stark and Wetzel luncheon meats are made just one way, from fine-grade meats, tender, lean cuts of U.S. government-inspected meat, quality-controlled to maintain a perfect blend of flavor, purity, and natural protein nourishment. You can please everyone all the time when you serve Stark and Wetzel luncheon meats for sandwiches, snacks, party platters, even in sauces and dips. So cater to your family's tastes. Choose their favorites from over 20 varieties. Slice fresh every day and vacuum sealed in 8-ounce packs to keep the freshest taste in town. Stark and Wetzel, the freshest taste in town.
This is Indy Sports Center, 1070, The Fan. WFNI, Indianapolis.
And it's the all-night race party. Mike Sarwick along with you. We're here until 6 in the morning, featuring the races currently of 1968. We'll be going forward to 1978 here in about 3 hours, as well as reliving last year's memories. It is just activity all galore downtown Indianapolis. They shut off traffic at the Circle. They've got the skylights going on down here, too. So you just know that we're setting up for a great race, which is going to be taking place here, oh gosh, in a little bit less than or more than 12 hours, with all the coverage right here on 1070 The Fan. These doggone turbine engines are pretty intriguing, you know? You see them in jet aircraft. Now, these are much smaller versions. I heard these ones back in 1968 spun upwards of 50,000 RPM. Don't know if that's exactly true, but a little bit more on what was happening with the turbines and how many tried to qualify and what was going on behind the scenes. Donald Davidson.
There were four wedge-shaped turbines that were built by Lotus. And the lead driver was supposed to be Jim Clark, but he was fatally injured in a Formula 2 accident at Hockenheim, Germany on April the 7th. And then at the very beginning of May, and a track used to open on May the 1st in those days, Graham Hill was on the team, but they had four cars. So they wanted Jackie Stewart to be a replacement, and he was willing, but he couldn't pass the physical because he had a cracked wrist from an accident. I think it was in practice for the Spanish Grand Prix. So they brought in Mike Spence, who was a Brit, who was often the Lotus number two or BRM number two, and he kind of shuffled back and forth between the two. And times were different then. He was actually a contract BRM driver and released to drive for Lotus at Indianapolis. And anyway, he had an accident in practice. He actually ran above the track record with the car that was supposed to be Jim Clark's on May 7th, and he did 169.555 miles per hour, unofficial. And then later that day, Greg Weld who was on the fourth turbine. A lot of people think there was three of those cars. There were four. And Greg Weld was having difficulty, and so Mike Spence got in to drive it for a little bit. And then I think it was like 20 to 6 that evening, 20 minutes before the track was going to close or thereabouts, he had a huge accident in turn one. And then he passed away later that night. So the car that was the fastest at the track didn't have a driver. And Parnelli Jones was just virtually retired at that time. I don't know whether he'd actually said, "I retire," but I think he was within, you know, sometime during the month, it was out that he wasn't going to drive the 500 anymore or championship open wheel. He might run some stock cars and off-road racing. Anyway, he had become a car owner, and Joe Leonard was his driver, and they released Joe Leonard to drive the turbine, the 60 turbine, which was the, we'll call that the Clark car, and Leonard won the pole.
Night Race Party featuring 1968, back when we were all just a little bit younger. Also, a little bit later on, we're going to be playing some of the fond memories of reminiscing of these past years, and also what's coming up tomorrow with Paul Page and Bob Jenkins. By the way, a little bit of surprise, I don't mind saying this if you haven't heard it already. Last I heard, Paul Page returning to the radio network. You'll hear him on the broadcast tomorrow, and he'll be sharing about what his duties will be tomorrow. We're also going to be hearing Paul a little bit later on this evening. Sometime, I imagine, around midnight or so, we'll be going to the 1978 Indy 500, which will be, as Paul will mention, his time where he felt more comfortable, because in 1977 it was still his first time taking command after Sid's passing the year prior. That's all coming up on 1070 The Fan, the all-night race party. We're the fan, we're the race party, all the way until 6 o'clock in the morning, reliving the memories of 1968. You know, some of the things that were changing back in 68, some of the rules that we're so accustomed to today were a little different back then. Now, even though it has an effect on the conclusion of the 68 race, Donald fast-forwards to where we are right now and tells us what some of those rule differences are back then.
The rules were different in those days. The pace car didn't come out to back everybody up. You were supposed to slow down and hold your interval. You were supposed to note where the car was in front of you and then keep the relative position slowed down under the yellow. Well, some people were more honest than others. And there was a little ploy that the crowd didn't like at all. Art Pollard, I think, was like a lap or two down, as I recall. And he was between Joe Leonard, who was leading, and Bobby Unser, who was running second. And then there were some other lap cars in between. And then Pollard slowed way down. And the gap kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Bobby Unser's crew are frantically gesturing and complaining to the chief steward because the gap is widening and Bobby is trapped behind Art Pollard because you're not allowed to pass. You've got to be in single file. Well, finally, Fengler goes out onto the track and waves quite pointedly to Art Pollard to catch back up, which he does.
Fan, I'm Mike Serwick, your host of the All Night Race Party, reliving the 1968 memories. Been kind of keeping an eye on the different stations for the weather forecast. I guess for tomorrow, there is a slight chance of rain in the afternoon, a 30% chance, and a high of 81. I hope it's not as humid tomorrow as it is today. Boy, it was pretty sticky out there. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. You know, if it rains, does that mean that Dario automatically wins? That's just a philosophical question. Anyway, we had a chance to get caught up with Bobby Unser, and you've been hearing some of the audio, and we're going to hear more about the thoughts that were going through his head as the race finished. But while we got a few minutes, you know, it's been 40 years for Bobby, and of course, after he retired, he was in a booth with Paul Page for ABC News for a while. So I had the question to pose to him, what in the world are you doing today?
Well, I don't like to work for anybody, so I do a lot of, or not a lot, but I do real, real, real big cases for accident reconstruction. You know, like $30 to $100 million cases around the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoy it because I became a self-taught engineer mechanical engineer through automobile racing. Because if you'll fantasize back a little bit, that I was involved with the best teams that there were in IndyCar racing, period.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned a lot from the engineers. So I became one. I learned how to draw my own wings, my own suspensions. I learned how to use my own suspension board to scale. I did all the underneath of the cars. I was ahead of the whole world in doing that stuff for a long time. And it's all because I had an interest in it. Made my own wind tunnel in Albuquerque and did all of that stuff. Now, I don't do this in a mass job. So I just kind of what I call cherry picking.
Sure.
Maybe that's unfair, but nonetheless, I do it. I only do cases that I want to do. They might be in Boston, they might be in Phoenix, L.A., Lord only knows where.
Uh-huh.
But generally speaking, I don't do any in the state of New Mexico, which is where I live.
We're coming down to the last few laps of the 68 Indy 500 on 1070 The Fan, the all-night race party. I'm Mike Sarawick, your host. And you know what's about ready to happen? There's been several incidents happening, and they've all been pretty light in nature. Well, there's going to be another one dealing with Dennis Holmes. Donald describes something that is quite unusual, what happens during one of those calls.
Late in the race, Dan Gurney was running second, and Dennis Holmes, his teammate, was running in third place. So we're coming down into the late stages, and at that point, let's see, Leonard would have still been leading, Bobby Unser was second, Gurney was third, fourth was Dennis Holmes, the defending world champion, who was Gurney's teammate, and then fifth was Mel Kenyon, driving a car that was called the City of Lebanon, Indiana Specials. Marvelous story. Anyway, quite late, Dennis Holmes came in to make an extra pit stop. He had a tire going down, right rear going down, and the jack wouldn't work. And A.J. Foyt, defending winner and national champion, was out of the race, dressed in civvies, and Gordon Johncock, who was standing there dressed in civvies, jumped over the wall and helped the crew lift the back of the car up so that they could change the right rear on Dennis Holmes' car. Unbelievable. Well, that allowed Kenyon to go by, and in fact, I think that might even have been after Joe Leonard had dropped out of the race. So Holm dropped from third to fourth, and Kenyon went to third, which was a terrific story.
We're winding down 1968. What a year. Nice day, highs in the middle 60s. By the way, we're hoping for great weather later today. We know that last check of the weather, 30% chance of afternoon showers, cloudy. So if you're heading out to the track, it wouldn't hurt to take a slicker or an umbrella, just in case, if anything else, to ward away the clouds. Remember, 70% chance of no rain. We're winding down the race. Bobby Unser had some final thoughts of things that were rolling on through his head. He's going to share them with us, exactly what was going on as this thing was ready to come to an end.
No, because Carl Williams, I think it was Carl, I can't remember who it was on the back straightaway, had a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know if the officials were going to get, or the safety people were going to get the track cleaned up in time enough to go green. And so therefore, I knew how many laps I had to go because I could look up at the scoreboard.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't take a genius to read the number, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I knew that if we didn't have another yellow, there wasn't very many laps before the finish. But I could tell with the distance that Leonard was ahead, because Art Pollard, the other turbine that was still in the race, Andy Granatelli had told Art to hold me back, give Leonard more leeway.
No kidding.
Granatelli because everybody knew that. There was, 350,000 fans pounding on their chairs and doing everything.
Yeah.
Everybody saw it. So.
Uh-huh.
And the turbines weren't the favorites by any means as far as the crowd favorites.
Uh-huh.
And so I had that going against me, but when it went green, I could see Leonard way up ahead. And I knew that I would catch him at least by the white flag lap.
Mm-hmm.
And I could pass him in one straightaway. Because I figured that on the white flag lap that I'd catch him in the short chutes between 1 and 2 and pass him coming off 2 down the back straightaway because I would have so much more speed.
Mm-hmm.
And that I would be able to win it by, in a lap, I'd have probably been 10 car lengths ahead of him. But I could figure that out because I'd done this all day. And I had the transmission problem a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But now, had there, nobody likes to have an issue on daredevil type stuff for the last lap. So I reckon Leonard would have probably run all over the road or the track to keep me from passing.
Sure.
But it didn't make any difference. I'm a very dedicated person. I'd have got him passed. There's no question about that. But nobody likes to have a chance of having a wreck on the last lap.
Mm-hmm.
Me included.
Exactly.
So the bottom line was, is Leonard fuel pump quit, he pulled to the infield, and I had whatever laps that it was remaining to go. And then I'm worried about everything else happening, like a flat tire. Running over something on the track and having a flat tire would have been the demise of my winning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just worried about not Leonard, but just anything that could happen because I realized then, that was the first time I realized that I truly, truly, truly could win this race. You see, and I never knew until the race was over what happened to my transmission. Okay, so I didn't know that a U-joint on the gear shift had come apart, because so many times drivers have lost the Indy 500 at the very last.
Yeah.
But I just didn't want that to happen, so I worried about everything, and I was very conservative. I stayed where the track was the blackest, meaning there would be less chance of a piece of something falling off another car be there to have a blowout for me.
Uh-huh.
I was really worried a bunch because now I know I really have it in the palm of my hand. And then it was so sweet because I came off a number 2 turn after running the extra lap, and I looked out in the straightaway, in the back straightaway, and there were thousands of people out there. You just wouldn't believe. And I got tears in my eyes right uh-huh. then and there. I mean, all these people had jumped the fences and everything to come out and help celebrate Bobby Unser winning the race.
Really?
And I knew that they can't take it away from me for any reason. But I really did win the Indianapolis 500.
Race party. We just heard the 1968 Indy 500. We're going to go 10 more years ahead of time. It's still 30 years ago, though. It was 1978, and that was the year that Paul Page took the airway again, or host of the Indy 500. Also, it's sad news to report, and that's what we're going to do, is we're going to dedicate this race to the late Larry Rice. Larry was in this race. We're going to hear his name coming up in just a few minutes, of course. And he was, Donald will describe of how he was a very good and well-plugged-in local person who had a lot of activities throughout central Indiana. He passed away, I believe, Friday of a battle with cancer. And he was also co-rookie of the year with Rick Mears. Donald will give the bio and everything about the late Larry Rice, who, of course, again, we dedicate this race to. So let's do it without further ado. 1978 Indy 500 on 1070. On 1070, The Fan. It's the all-night race party, reliving the memories of 1978. We just heard Paul Page give the starting grid for the 78 race. And I knew this too, that Larry Rice was driving the car for WIBC as well as Bryant. Now, who was Larry Rice? We knew that he did some activity earlier in the 70s, but Donald gives us a little bit more of a more detailed bio.
Probably one of the big surprises of the 78 race was that going in, you just assumed that Rick Mears was the shoe-in for the Rookie of the Year because he was driving for Roger Penske. He was on the front row. And anyway, so he dropped out, and Larry Rice, who was from Linden, Indiana, went to Ball State. He'd been a school teacher and driving USAC midgets and sprints and champ dirt cars, had a 500 ride. He actually had one in 74, and the car wasn't up to the task, and he didn't even make a qualifying attempt. But here he was in the field, and I remember him saying that when he qualified, He was going down the backstretch, and there were tears in his eyes because he'd been going there since he was a little boy as a spectator with his family. And now he was going to be driving in it. Well, very late in the race, he was running 10th. And he popped an engine, and I think it was Alonso was coming down for the white flag, I think. The race was virtually over, and so he had to shut down, coming down the straightaway, pulled to the inside, and then pulled, I think he pulled off into the turn one grass, and then Johnny Parsons, who was running 11th, was able to move to 10th, but Rice ended up 11th. So, the Rookie of the Year was voted upon by probably about 35 press and officials and other dignitaries, and you would vote your first choice, second choice, and third choice. And when they totted up the balloting the next day, the victory banquet was the night after the race, and prior to the victory banquet, there was a reception where they would announce the Rookie of the Year. So the votes would be gathered the night of the race and through the next morning, and I think the cutoff was sort of like, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something. And so the word got around that it was a tie. And they had two people on their ballot couldn't decide between the two of them. And so instead of doing first choice, second choice, third choice, they put both names on the top line and then nobody in the second choice. Two people did that. And so they called them over and said, look, we don't normally do this, but we're going to ask you to file another vote, another ballot. So here's yours, you go over there. Here's yours, you go over there and come back. And so one voted for one first with the other second, and the other did it the reverse way. And so the organizer said, all right, we give up. It's a tie. But anyway, it was great because Larry Rice was co-Rookie of the Year, which you never would have dreamed going in. And it's really neat because it's the answer to a trivia question. You know, either Larry Rice was co-Rookie of the Year, who was the other guy, or the other way around. And Rick Mears has always been very, very sporting about it. I mean, he's a wonderful human being. And they talked, I think, not too long ago. Every now and again, they run into each other, and Mears is just so sporting about it.
Thank you, Darrell Weibel. As the cars slow for turn three, then the wind becomes important to the aerodynamics of the cars. There is a windsock atop a 44-story span that the drivers view and react to. Just below that wind indicator sits our third-turn announcer, a 13-year veteran.
Now, the problem is not in your radio set at all. Paul Page will tell us a little bit later on that they had problems with Armed Forces radio network, and when they hooked it up to their radio equipment, they got some sort of back feedback that was causing this ripple. Back in 1978, WIBC actually thought it might have been something in their radio broadcast. They shut down their transmitter and powered it back up. It fooled everybody, but it was all back at the raceway control. So the ripple is part of the actual race as it took place back in 1978.
The fourth turn. This may be the scene of all the accidents it has so far this month. We hope there are no accidents. The drivers can either turn into the pits or down the main straightaway. In either case, the reports will come to you from our 31-year veteran, Jim Shelton. Jim?
1070 The Fan is your place for the all-night race party with 1978. We just heard Paul Page open it up for us with the drop of the green flag and a drop of a couple of yellow flags as well. Something kind of curious happened during that first yellow flag. Had a chance to get caught up with Rick Mears, and he'll share a little inside secret you may not have known about.
That is correct. That is correct. Actually, it was after the race started. We were fortunate enough to catch a yellow. And it went green, and I went down the front straightaway, and the helmet started raising off my head. And so I had to reach up and grab it and pull it down. And so now I'm running around with one hand, driving with one hand, because I didn't have the nerve at first to call in my first race with Penske and say, hey, guys, my helmet's unbuckled. So I lived with it for as long as I could, and then finally radioed in and said, guys, this is what happened, and fortunately we caught a yellow fairly quick and got to get it hooked back up. Well, you know, at the time, you don't think too much about it, other than the fact you got to get in and you're working on trying to get everything done as quickly as possible and get back going again. So there wasn't much time to really reflect on it at the time. But actually, I ate at two or three races down the road. I found out what happened. I was kind of late getting in the car because I was trying to keep the nerves down and stay in the garage as long as possible and stay relaxed, and which I've always tried to do before the race rather than get all excited and pumped up. And in doing that, I was almost late getting in the car, so I was in a hurry. And I stuck the strap through the two eyes and looped it and came back, and I missed going around the second loop. But when I pulled it, it kind of rolled up and pulled snug. But I only pulled it once because I was late and jumped in the car. A couple races later, I did the same thing. I pulled it and went tight, and then I found a little tighter, and I pulled it again, and it popped it through. And that's basically what happened.
1070 The Fan, it's the all-night race party. 1978, we have Rick Mears. Of course, he became the third four-time winner of the Indy 500. Now, this was his rookie year. Plus, we had some other team entries. What Donald Davidson has is a little bit of a summary of Team Hill, and Rick Mears, in his own words, what it was like racing for Team Penske his very first time.
Jim Hall, legendary Jim Hall of Chaparral fame, big in Can-Am, had never had a 500 entry before, and he entered in 1978. With Al Unser as his driver, so that made it a very formidable entry. And the year before, 77, Tom Sneva, driving for Penske, was the first person to do a 200-mile-an-hour lap in qualifying. Laps 1 and 2 were 200, but 3 and 4 dropped off considerably, and so his 4-lap average, I think, was like 198.9. But in 1978... Sneva, the entire front row was over 200. I think Sneva had like a 203, and Danny Ongais was next to him, and then third was the new boy on the Penske team, Rick Mears, who had been a rookie the year before but hadn't qualified for somebody out for another car owner, and now he was with Penske. And The Penske team for 78 was Tom Sneva and Mario Andretti, but because Mario Andretti was going for the World Championship, there was going to be some conflicts. So Mears was sort of the third man on the totem pole, and the arrangement was that he would drive the second car when Mario was not available, and that for the 500-mile races at Indianapolis, Pocono, and Ontario, they'd run three. So he really stamped himself immediately by qualifying outside front row.
You're talking about help steepening the learning curve, you know, to be able to have those two for teammates and access to the equipment and the engineers and everything on this team was, you know, just learned it. I mean, I got it first time I drove the Team Penske car at Phoenix, and after about three laps, I thought, oh, this is the way they're supposed to feel, you know, because I had no idea, you know, until you don't know until you get in one that's handling properly, you know, the way it's supposed to. So, you know, and then all the help from Tom and Mario, you know, just the standard, okay, go to a new track and either mainly just watching and listening in that respect. But also if I had any questions, you know, they were great working with me, and we'd run around track in a rental car beforehand or something like that and point some things out. So they were just, you know, they were excellent.
Way, you know, getting underway at 6 o'clock, you're going to have a whole cast of characters. Basically, the air crews from Hank FM and also 1070 The Fan, that's us, and WIBC are going to be teaming up, and that all gets underway at 6 o'clock. A lot of fun out at the Speedway, taking you all the way until, I believe it's 12 noon, and then you have the IMS radio network that starts at noon, and the drop of the flag at 1:05. Now, we had a chance to get caught up with Rick Mears. It was a really great chat we had over the phone a couple days ago. And had a chance to ask Rick, basically, you know, because I grew up with the guy being already in an esteemed position of a proven driver. But you got to wonder, what was the first few times working with or meeting Roger Penske, and how did that go? He answers that question.
Well, actually, you know, the first time I'd ever really spoken with Roger, I was sitting on a pit wall after my second attempt, and I had one attempt left, and this is in 77, and when I was driving that Pink Eagle. And you know, I'm sitting there scratching my head, and he walks by and says, "How you doing, Mears?" And I said, "Ah, struggling. I just, you know, we've tried everything we can think of, and we're still about a mile and a half short." And he says, "Well," he says, "main thing, just don't stick it in the fence." You know, and off he went down the pit lane, and that's really, you know, all we, first time we'd ever spoken. And really kind of the next time we were on Wally Dallenbach's ride, the Colorado 500, and, you know, later at the end of that year, and he was on the ride, and there was about 35 of us, and, you know, Unzers and Gurney, a bunch of people, a bunch of drivers, Parnelli, and one morning we were getting the bikes ready to go for the next day's ride outside the hotel and just, you know, getting things set, and we got to talking, and he says, "I hear you thinking about driving for so-and-so next year," because I didn't have anything going at the time. And I said, "No." And I said, "I hear you're thinking about hiring so-and-so next year." And he says, "No." So we talked a little more, and pretty soon he says, but he said, "I've got something in mind. Give me a deal, or give me a call before you make a deal with anybody else." Well, needless to say, I about fell over, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Total surprise to me. So I followed Roger very close the rest of that ride. You know, if he fell off his bike, I'd pick him up and dust him off and straighten his handlebars, you know, and send him on his way. But, no, it was quite a shock to me as much as anybody.
1070 The Fan. It's the All Night Race Party, 1978. You know, they were talking about Mario Andretti and how he ended up running toward the end, actually started at the very last position of the race. And with that, Donald Davidson fills in the blanks.
Mike Hirst was either at the track looking for a ride and didn't get one and went home, or he didn't even come. He was trying to do it by phone. Mario Andretti was running for the world championship in Formula One at that time. He'd run the year before and finished third. And in 78, he was running for it again and ended up winning it. But he was going to try and run the 500, and I think he was going to do Indianapolis, Pocono, and Ontario, I believe was all he was going to do. So anyway, the first qualifying weekend was clear. There were no conflicts, but the first qualifying weekend got rained out. The second weekend, he had to go to the Belgian Grand Prix. So they thought about, you know, flying back and forth and back and forth, and they thought that's really too much. They got permission that somebody else could qualify the car and Mario could start at the back. They didn't want to make a habit of that, but Mario Andretti's a different situation. And so Mike Hirst was brought in, and his whole job was build the car up to speed, qualify it, don't break any track records, just get it in the show, and then hand it over to Mario. So he did that. And then I think as soon as he was qualified, he flew back to Tustin, California, which was in the San Francisco area, I believe. And then it was decided, well, we could use a driver expert. Let's get him. So he turned around and came back again. And that, I believe that's the only year that he did that, but he was a driver expert on the 78 race.
The day is done.
Coming home.
It's time to let it go. It's the moment to unwind.
Welcome home.
So just say, bud.
Just say, bud.
Just a cold golden reminder, friends. You'll enjoy whatever you're doing even more with a glass of the king of beers, Budweiser.
Because when you say Budweiser, you've said it all.
Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis.
Sarawak, your host of the All Night Race Party, reliving the memories of 1978. And just kind of keep an eye on the weather forecast, still not changing very much. Last I heard, and that was just a few minutes ago, is that we might get some sunshine, but it looks like more clouds and a 30% chance of rain, 70% chance that we don't. And that's for when we drop the flag at 105 today. And you can hear all the action right here on 1070 The Fan. We're also reliving some conversation that we had with Rick Mears a couple days ago. And, you know, when Rick rode in this race as a rookie and also the first time running for Penske, he's actually running a 1978 car when he ran a year later in 1979. And the interesting thing about there is there was some breakthrough technology that is just everyday place in racing today called ground effects. And Rick tells us a little bit about the story behind the car that he drove and how he let go so that Bobby could have a ground effects car.
Mainly because I was not familiar with that car, and Roger and Bobby had done all the development work on it and all the testing, and matter of fact, he kind of kept me out of the car. But not really, but yeah, Bobby was a competitor. But as it turned out, when we got close to race time, being a new car, Roger, you know, it's kind of like, let's get one of each out there. But he actually gave me my choice. And then he said, what do you think? I said, I know Bobby's been doing all of the testing and development work in the new car. He said, you've got your choice. You decide which one you want to run. And I chose to stay with the 6 because that's the car I'd really learned in, and I was more familiar with it.
Turbo, it dominates the Indianapolis 500. Turbo, it dominates Le Mans. And now, Turbo is at your local Saab dealer, and you have the chance to test the Saab Turbo and unleash yourself. Feel power, pure power at your command. It's Turbo Power, harnessed to perform when you really need it. Feel Turbo Power thrust you onto a busy highway. Feel Turbo Power surge you forward when you have to pass. Turbo Power from Saab in a stunning three-door fastback with front-wheel drive, rack and pinion steering, fuel injection, rear spoiler. Get a hold of the wheel of the Saab Turbo. Feel what it's like to unleash yourself with the ultimate in racing power. Turbo Power. Test drive the Saab Turbo. You're in for an astonishing driving experience.
Test the Saab Turbo at your local Saab dealer.
This is Indy Sports Center, 1070, The Fan. WFNI, Indianapolis.
1070, The Fan, the all-night race party. Mike Sarwick, your host. We still have a couple hours left together, you know that? Little cloudy outside. I walked out there just a few minutes ago. It's actually pretty nice around the circle. Anyway, you know, we've been listening to the various names. We've been hearing a lot about the Unsers, the Mirrors, and everybody else. But you know a name that we've just not been hearing a lot about in this race, but actually made some records, is Janet Guthrie. Donald Davidson tells us more.
And he took off, and he had about a 30-second lead on Tom Sneva when the stops were completed. And in the closing laps, Sneva started to gather in the slack. Al slowed down. The thinking was that he may have impaired his handling by sliding into this right front wing, which had hit the wheel. And when I asked him about it a few years ago, he said, oh no, he said it didn't trouble the handling at all. That Janet Guthrie was in the race. It was her third year at the track, but she hadn't qualified in 76. This was her second start. She was an early out in 77. And she had put together her own team. And she was running a Patrick Wildcat that they got from the George Bignotti headed up operation. And she finished ninth, which not only was the finest finish by a woman, it would remain so until 2005 when Danica Patrick came along and finished in fourth place. It came to light after the race was over that she had actually driven effectively one-handed because she had a cracked wrist. 2 or 3 days before the race, she had played in a charity tennis tourney, and she wore cork wedgies, which wasn't the best footwear that you could use for playing tennis, and she tripped and fell. Reached out to break her fall, and went to a friend and said, I think I've done myself an injury. So the friend said, oh no, we better get you to the hospital, get you to the doctor. And she said, no, take me to the drugstore and we'll get some painkiller and bandages and stuff like that. No, I'm not going to the hospital because they may tell me I can't drive, and we've come too far. There's too much invested. I'm going to drive in the race. And so she managed to, she had a couple of friends that worked with her in being able to pull this off. And so nobody knew, basically. And she drove in the race and effectively one-handed. It was an amazing job.
And the all-night race party, 1978 year. We just heard Rick Mears fall out his rookie year, so he didn't finish the race, but he didn't do too bad either. You know, he had one victory, and then in 1982 was that phenomenal race between Gordon Johncock and Rick Mears, and that was just neck and neck throughout the whole race, and it was a phenomenal event. And when I was talking with Rick a couple days ago, I had to ask him what that was like. Was that really kind of the most fun event that he'd ever been to?
Oh, it was. Yeah, obviously we're competitors and we hate to finish second. But I felt like, you know, we'd gotten everything we could out of the car. We'd done the best job we could do, and we'd made up, 11, 12 laps, and everybody knew who ran second. But, and I was also tickled for Gordy because he didn't really get to appreciate his first win. And, I remembered earlier in the day during the race thinking, you know, if we can't, I'd like to see Gordy win it. But, so it was a fun race. Obviously we wanted to win the thing, but, that's one of the few that you're kind of semi-happy running second.
'70, the Fan, the all-night race party, remembering 1978. Hard to believe it's been 30 years ago. And the voice you've been listening to, Paul Page, he's actually going to be back on the network this year. You'll hear him. He believes in a kind of like a Chris Economaki mode. He's going to be helping out with the broadcast later on. By the way, speaking of things that were different back then, 1978, some of the things were changing on the track rule-wise. Donald Davidson fills us in.
And if there was something that would, the one thing about this race was this was the final race which did not have the pace car come out for the pack-ups. That in 1979 they finally decided every time there's a yellow, the pace car will go out onto the track, pick up the leader, and everybody will pull up in single file behind it in a parade. 78 was the last year that they didn't do that. Tony Holman had passed away in October of 77. In May of 77, there was the... I couldn't understand why they went to so much trouble. I mean, it would have been quite simple, I would have thought, but what to say? You couldn't say, gentlemen, start your engines. And what he finally came up was a rather cumbersome, in company with the first lady ever to qualify at Indianapolis, comma, except they didn't say comma, gentlemen, start your engines. And so then the following year, Janet Guthrie's in the field again, and now Mrs. Holman, old Mrs. Holman, and she did a much simpler, lady and gentlemen, start your engines.
Kmart is your savings store, where your dollar buys you more.
Summer's the time for good music, and Kmart's the place for GE AM/FM portables that pick up TV sound, weather reports, even CB, plus a huge selection of GE 8-track players and cassette recorders. So pick up some music to go from General Electric at Kmart.
Kmart is the saving place.
1978. We're finishing up our chat we had earlier with Rick Mears. I had a chance to ask him, you know, a lot of drivers, if you think about it, including AJ, when he retired, he didn't get it out of the system. He came back a year later. But when Rick retired, it was a solid decision. Never considered. But I had to find out for myself. So I asked him, what was he thinking? And when did he come upon that the decision to when it was finally time to retire?
Oh, I'd been thinking about it for about a year, probably right around then. And, I'd been thinking about probably about a year before I actually did it. But it's just the old desire start going away. And once I noticed that, I knew that the performance would be right on its heels. And, cause if the desire goes away, you don't dig down deep enough to do that little bit that you need to do to really be competitive. And that wouldn't be fair to the team or the sponsors or anybody else. So, and if you're not doing that, you're not going to be competitive. You won't win races. And if you aren't competitive, it's not any fun.
And you've never reconsidered?
No. No, that was the right time right time, right place for me.
The Fan, the all-night race party. We're getting pretty close to our 11th hour and joining everybody on the MS communication side from Hank FM, WIBC, and, of course, 1070 The Fan, where all the activity gets underway at 6 o'clock this morning. They're going to get you safely into the track, keep you informed, and make sure that this is a great race day for you, as we do this traditional thing every year. It's our 13th year. And as we relive the memories of 1978, we have some things we can't forget. And as you see, we're winding things down. But what happened is there was some confusion going on in the pits with Al Unser. Did he hit something? I'm not too sure. Of course, we always have Donald Davidson to help us out. He's going to straighten it out and let us know exactly what happened.
And he took off, and he had about a 30-second lead on Tom Sneva when the stops were completed. And in the closing laps, Sneva started to gather in the slack. Al slowed down. The thinking was that he may have impaired his handling by sliding into this right front wing, which had hit the wheel. And when I asked him about it a few years ago, he said, "Oh no," he said, "it didn't trouble the handling at all." He said, "I realized I had a good lead, and it'd be better if I kind of slowed down and protected it." And so, I don't remember what the margin was. I think it was only like 8 seconds or something like that. But he did that deliberately, because he just figured, it doesn't matter, you know, what the gap is, that winning is important. And if you can bring it home in one piece and slow down and baby it, there's no sense blowing up going for a track record in the closing stages. So that's Al. I mean, he was just the master tactician by that time. And it was his third 500 victory.
And that's the way that the 1978 Indy 500 shaped up for you. And you heard it all here on 1070, The Fan, the all-night race party. Want to give thanks to Bob Jenkins, Paul Page, Dan McGowan, he's been there helping us record stuff, as well as Kent Sterling and Michael Grady, all a part of making the all-night race party a huge success and a tradition on The Fan.
This is Indy Sports Center, 1070, The Fan. WFNI, Indianapolis.